This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is the San Francisco Green Film Festival, Film Stories from Your Dining Plate. And our panel tonight is with Rachel Kaplan, who's the CEO of the San Francisco Green Festival. And next to her is Misha Hedges, who's director as the director of The Sea, a film. Bradshaw, is that correct, Galen?
Brashear,
who's co-directed Eyes on the Water, and Jason Hansik, who's co-director of Eyes on the Water. So I'll turn it over to you now, Rachel, and we will begin our program.
Thank you, Anne. It's great to be back. Tonight, I'm joined by three leading Bay Area filmmakers for a discussion about the role of filmmakers who are delving into our complex food system with the farmers, chefs, food lovers, and campaigners who are changing the status quo. Films that tell the stories behind bringing food to the dinner table and make you ask the question, what's on my plate? This question, what's on your plate, is also the spotlight theme for our 2017 festival this year in April, where we'll be bringing you a visual feast of films that are shaping the story of food justice and sustainability. To see more films, meet filmmakers, and dig further into the stories on our plates, please join me at the Green Film Festival April 20th through 26th with 70 new films at the Castro Theatre, Roxy, and venues across San Francisco and Berkeley. So huge welcome to our guests tonight. I'm going to give a brief bio for each of the guests, and then we'll get into the conversation. I wanted to share more details about the great work that they've done because I think it's really interesting. So Jason, we'll start with you, Jason, at the end of the table here. Jason Hanasek is a San Francisco-based artist, curator, and filmmaker. His work has been featured in exhibition and print form in the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery, the Los Angeles Times, Bloomberg Businessweek, and Routledge's Critical Military Studies. He has a Master of Fine Arts from California College of the Arts and a Bachelor of Fine Arts from the State University of New York. He's currently a Dean's Fellow focusing on documentary film and 360 video and immersive media at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you.
Graylin Brashear is a multimedia journalist and master's candidate at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. She earned a degree in journalism and media studies from Rutgers, is that right? Rutgers University, and has worked as a print reporter and editor in daily, online, and weekly publications. Her radio reporting has been featured on public radio stations in Alaska and California and on American Public Media's Marketplace. Misha Hedges is a social entrepreneur and award-winning documentary filmmaker. His last feature-length documentary, Of the Sea, was a film about California fishermen, and Sustainable Table, What's on Your Plate, a film about food and farming. Misha has an MBA in sustainable enterprise from Dominican University's Green MBA program and co-founded TrimTrab Media, a communications agency. When he's not telling stories, you'll find him outside trail running, surfing, and biking. I know this because I follow you on social media. So welcome, Misha.
Thanks. Thank you.
I'm excited to jump into our conversation tonight. You've all made really compelling films about food issues in general, and I think about sustainable seafood issues in particular. So for me, the first question is, there are a million stories on every dinner plate. Tell me a little bit more about how you came to tell your food story. Can I start with you, Jason and Graylin?
Sure, yeah. You want to go ahead and start because you brought the story to, to me.
So Jason and I are colleagues at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism, and a little over a year ago, Jason helped me with a shoot in Tiburon, and we were talking to a scientist there who was doing research on Pseudonychia, this algae that is actually what shut down California's crab fishery last year. It produces domoic acid, which can accumulate in shellfish. It's a potent neurotoxin, and it can kill you, which is why you all weren't allowed to eat Dungeness crab last year. And as we were leaving, this researcher had told us about a program up in Alaska, this really unprecedented cooperative effort to monitor this exact algae and others like it, because it was a threat to subsistence food resources, to clams, to shellfish up there. And as we were leaving, we said, we should make a film about that. And with some funding from Berkeley, we went up last spring to Southeast Alaska and met some extraordinary people and came back with a great story.
And Misha, how did you dive into the story of the California fisherman in Off the Sea?
Right. So about 10 years ago, I made a film about sustainable food and farming. It was my thesis film right out of film school, or at the end of film school. And it went to festivals and did pretty well. And every festival that we went to, people would ask me, why didn't you include seafood in this? Because we did cover animal agriculture, but not seafood. And it just felt like this whole other topic. And about 7 years after that, I was at a conference at a speaking gig. I'd been working on documentaries and doing our client work at TrimTab. And this woman came up to me and said, hey, I have this great idea to do these short profiles about fishermen and what it means to be a fisherman and what it means to do that work and risk your life to go out on the ocean and bring back food for people. And so she had put together a small grant application, and we got the grant, and we went out and we filmed the first day. And as soon as we filmed the first day, I knew that there was this larger story here. And then we filmed the second day, then we filmed the third day, and we had almost used up our budget. And we just decided to keep going. And so we raised more funds, and it just kind of was this snowball that kept growing bigger and bigger. And instead of a couple of 2 minute mini documentaries, it ended up being a 90 minute or an 80 minute feature about five different fisheries off the California coast and the people who participate in them. What we really tried to do with the film is also include a section about how we, as people who eat seafood, can influence the market positively or negatively based on what we choose to eat or not to eat.
So you found your food story. You turn up in the communities where you're filming. You say, I'm a filmmaker. I'm here to tell your story. How easy was it to gain people's trust? Or what? How do you work with the characters that you meet? And are there any... I believe you shared an interesting story with me earlier about that, Jason.
Yeah, sure. We were flying into Sitka, and on the flight I met a gentleman that was sitting next to me, and he was telling me about how he had just come back, I believe, from Seattle, from a conference. I'm from the South originally, and it felt like I was meeting a Southerner, because he immediately invited us over for dinner. And we went there knowing that we wanted to tell a science-based story that was full of a ton of facts, but we wanted to fold it in to a human story. And we wanted to figure out, you know, what did it mean for an indigenous population's whole way of subsistence, you know, of subsistence food source? What does it mean when that starts to get poisoned? And how does that affect your cultural identity? What does that mean as you're passing that along to your children? Because it's also a way of life. It's not just what's on your plate. It's kind of the whole thing. And we immediately, it was the Atkinsons, and they're featured in our documentary, in our short doc. And we immediately saw when he opened up his freezer that his savings account was the gold that was sitting in his freezer, which was all of the different types of shellfish that he had captured. And so, Graylin and I both looked at each other and we realized what was, you know, there's the science, right? You can sit there and you can have a conceptual conversation, but that was what was at stake in our film, because he had a 4-year-old daughter running around and he was now having to make a decision whether or not he was going to share the food that he had just, you know, dug up with his daughter, knowing that if any piece of that shellfish had been contaminated, she would die immediately. And there was no way that he could cook it out or see the shellfish. And in many ways, what we knew was happening there, which was this collaboration between the tribes and also, amongst the tribes, but it's also an international reporting system that's been set up to gather information about these toxins. He knew that getting this story out of Alaska, which has been fairly widely reported about what's happening, and the way in which these tribes have been empowered to save themselves in a certain way and to do this type of work so that they can share knowledge that they have gained through the years of living in this one specific geographic area and marry that with, you know, microscopes and all different types of testing, they feel they recognized the power of that. So they immediately welcomed us in and said, please, whatever we can do, you know, we're happy to share that information with you.
I think that it's a really great question, because as a reporter, like anytime you go into a community and you're asking people to share their story, especially on camera, which is very new to me, Jason is more experienced in that realm, it's a really big deal. You know, you're asking people to share very private things, to put themselves in front of you, and it's tough. And some parts of where we were in Southeast Alaska, where it's mostly Native communities, they're pretty cut off from a lot of the rest of the world, and you are suspect if you go in, and triply so with a camera. And it was tough. But just going with humility and saying, look, something's happening in your community, and we want to take it out into the wider world, you know, you gain trust that way.
Misha, did you find that with the California fishermen?
Yeah, I mean, with commercial fishermen, they're a fairly vilified group of people. I think we're all familiar with the kind of empty oceans, empty nets types of documentaries where that really show the most dire examples of fisheries that are completely depleted, and the fishermen are portrayed as these people who are the people who are, in their words, raping and pillaging the ocean. And so when we set out to make this film, we really wanted to feature fishermen that were doing that were fishing responsibly, and that were doing so legally within the regulations. Our fisheries in California especially are managed very well, and in America. But we still had to gain their trust as filmmakers. So part of that was just telling them the film that we were setting out to make, and part of it was spending time with them. And you know, before we whipped out the cameras, and that's something that most documentary filmmakers will tell you before you take out the cameras. Hopefully, you're having dinner with that person before you're shoving it in their face. But there were some examples of fishermen that did not want to talk to us, or fishermen who took a while to warm up to us. Also, we were on fishing boats for 24 hours with these fishermen, completely at their mercy in the middle of the ocean. So we didn't want to do anything to piss them off. But I will say that everyone who ended up in our film was fantastic to work with, and just truly an amazing group of hardworking people who literally are by hand pulling fish out of the ocean for us in many cases.
I think after that we should take a look at a clip from the film, so I'll just get it queued up.
Being alone out in the ocean is no problem. I've been doing this for 50-some years. To be able to handle fishing is to be able to be out there with just you and your crew and your boat somewhere where, you know, there's no one around to either help or hinder what you're doing. So I was always, from a little kid, fascinated with fishing. I'm always amazed at what we can pull out of the ocean sometimes.
Fishing is so restricted that there is a lot less seafood that is coming off of these docks. There are a lot less fishermen these days that can afford to actually fish because of the closures. And you're seeing kind of people like myself and Scott and a lot of the other younger fishermen that have kind of adapted to that.
So my hope for the future is that we can leverage technology to increase the efficiencies and streamline the supply chain so that people can buy directly from the fishermen, which currently is almost impossible unless you live right next to a major pier or harbor.
On a Wednesday, you know, we'll call fishermen up and see what they're catching. We process it on Mondays, and then it goes out for distribution. in a world that's speeding up, the thing that I think we should all be really cautious of and the thing that we should be paying more attention to is the time that we have with our food. So it's not just about a piece of protein on your plate, but it's about where this fish is coming from and the individuals that brought it to you.
There's something romantic about this last source of food that we get from the wild. Our generation has the opportunity to either see the end of commercial fishing for the first time in history, or make sure that there's plenty of fish in the sea for generations to come.
So, Misha, what has the response been like to this? I know you've been showing this film in many coastal communities. What has the response been like?
So we brought the film to, I think, a little over 10 film festivals and several handfuls of community screenings, mostly in California, but a few screenings on the East Coast and beyond. And we also had a PBS premiere in California. We're hoping to bring that into the national PBS network as well. And the film was just released on Amazon. And so far, the response has been great. At the end of each screening, when we have a chance to talk with the audience after they've seen this film, they're asking what we can do. And that is a really... that's how our film ends, is by giving some general tips as to how we as seafood eaters can vote with our dollars to bring local seafood to markets and restaurants near us and support that, as opposed to buying fish that has come from overseas and is less likely to have been caught or farmed responsibly. And also, I was very relieved that all of the fishermen who we spoke with, agree that the film is fair. We definitely present some perspectives from kind of the regulatory side and the sustainability side that aren't always in fishermen's favor and that they struggle with. And there's some definitely some headbutting that goes on there. But it's a good kind of headbutting. And there are more fishermen and regulators of fisheries who are sitting in the same room and talking about this stuff and figuring out how to compromise in a way that doesn't harm the fishery and also doesn't harm the fishermen and their livelihoods, because it's a pretty... intense way to make a living, and it's also often full of scarcity in times where either there's not a season for, say, crab because of domoic acid, or when there aren't enough salmon and when the salmon quotas are much lower. So it's been great so far, and it's been empowering and exciting to see people ready to take action with their food choices.
So you mentioned that the impact campaign for the film, the toolkit that you have, and I believe you'll have action points as well for your film when it debuts next month at the Green Film Festival. So my question is about, I believe film can be a real tool for change, but how do you know if it's making a difference? And so it's a hard question, but... how can stories make a difference to people in our lives?
Yeah. That's really why we're all here, right?
Yeah.
All stories, any piece of information that you want to share, you can make it into a human story. And I really think that that's what the best stories do, no matter what medium it's in. You bring fellow humans in front of people and let them speak. And that is always moving, and it's always going to teach you something.
Yeah. And I would just add, I think we watched this year with the Best Picture winner Moonlight, where, there are bodies that are not normally represented and identities that are not normally represented on that large of a scale. And for it to be validated, it created a space for a new myth you know, a new mythology to be born around what Black gay male masculinity can look like. And is there more space in that needs to be built into that body? Of course. But that's a beginning. Mm-hmm. And every film we make, either positive or negative, you know, instills a new myth inside of the consciousness of the viewer. And so if you present, especially in the documentary space, something that is counter to what the dominating myth is, you know, I mean, I think that we're all sitting in wonder around all the rolling changes that are coming from our government at this moment. And, you know, I know that Graylin and I have been thinking about, well, what does this mean for the population, all of these people that we met while we were in Alaska, if the EPA suddenly disappears, you know, and children, you know, all the way up to seniors who have lived off of this specific type of shellfish and it is built into their complete identity, have no idea whether or not they're going to survive eating the piece of, you know, clam on their plate. That's terrifying. And I think, and I'm hoping that by getting the story out of Alaska and into the larger consciousness, it brings some awareness to ways in which we can empower populations, you know, globally to be able to do this type of monitoring work. And that's just our film. I mean, that's what I think the power does.
This is Ann Clark, chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is the San Francisco Green Film Festival, Film Stories from Your Dining Plate, with Rachel Kaplan, CEO, San Francisco Green Film Festival, Misha Hedges, Director of the Sea, Galen Brashear, Co-Director, Eyes on the Water, and Jason Hanasek, whom you just heard, Co-Director, Eyes on the Water. Rachel?
Jason, I'm really interested in what you were saying about myth and the power of myth. So we talk a lot about myth and storytelling. It's certainly an art. Do you see that as different to journalism? Mm-hmm. Graylin, it's a good question for you as well.
Oh, that's such a great question. And I do want to let Jason take this, but there are ways that those intersect. Actually, and it's great to be able to talk about this. We are an interesting pair. We come from different backgrounds in this space. And I was very head down in science about this story in particular. You know, we're like, okay, there's an environmental problem. We're going to go report on it. And I'm so glad that I have this extraordinary partner who was very much always the reminder of, like, this is a people story. We're, you know, where are the people? And what's their deal? And actually, this question of where is... There has to be a myth underlying this extraordinary cultural connection to a food resource. And Jason is the one who dug that up. You should actually tell the rest of that story.
Can I tee it up and then would you show?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I just had this question. You don't have something that's integral to the way in which you live, and there's no way that it doesn't appear in your origin myth in some manner. It just can't. I mean, that's how we understand the world, right? The myths that we tell, regardless of where you know, transhistorically, we've seen this happen. And so I was a dog with a bone when we went to Alaska. I said, I will figure out what is the origin myth, because I have just this sneaking feeling that we're going to find shellfish there. And we did.
He was right.
Kuala kila kusna kwa kila kusna kwalam ji Kuala hiya ho Yahweh.
The creation story of the Haida is Raven was, he was walking down the beach one day and he seen a giant clamshell on the beach. And he could see these little hands and faces peeking out of the clamshell. And he went over and he opened up the clamshell and all these little people jumped out of the clamshell. And so we're pretty linked into the cockle or the clam as part of our culture. It's where we came from. Our old saying is when the tide's out, the table's set. So you can imagine if somebody put something on your table that could kill you, the concern that you would have.
Oh. It's a short little teaser that we've made for the film because it's a short doc.
And I'm very excited that we are going to be having the world premiere of this film on April 23rd at the Green Film Festival. So thank you.
We're so excited to be there. It's an honor.
Giving us that honor. Our full program will be announced next week on March 23rd, and you can find the full details at greenfilmfest.org. Misha also has a film that's having its world premiere at the Green Film Festival. A slight change of topic, but can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so you were talking a bit about the political climate. As the campaigns were kind of coming up to a close and the election was happening, I was thinking a lot about how I wanted to show up as a storyteller in this time. There are so many stories that we can be telling, and part of the challenge is just deciding what you're going to lock onto. After the new president was elected, I started to hear about the Women's March that was being organized. And in early January, my team and I, 2 weeks before that happened, kind of pulled together and decided to make a film about people's experience marching and about what it means to participate in democracy and stand up when you feel your voice isn't being heard or your values are at stake. And so we sent 8 filmmakers to 4 different marches around the country, and we followed people throughout their experience in those marches. People from all different backgrounds and perspectives. And we're editing the film right now. I actually have a rough cut review session tomorrow, which I think you'll be happy to hear about. And thanks so much to the Green Film Festival. We had our Of the Sea San Francisco premiere of our film Of the Sea last year, the full-length version. And Rachel's agreed to show our film without seeing too much of it. So we're excited to bring it there, and we hope it'll live up to what we think, what we're hoping the film will be.
So that will be a world premiere on April 23rd at the Roxy Theatre. Probably the first time I'm seeing it too. Come and join us with the anticipation, So in all these, with all these stories, and with the political climate right now and threats that we're seeing to the EPA and the Paris Agreement, the Clean Power Plan across the board, how do we convey the state of things without it bringing people down and making them turn away?
Oh.
Oh.
That's so difficult. And I think as journalists, you know, part of your job is to be the filter through which all of that comes. So that can be difficult and challenging, you know, like you're, like Misha was saying, you sort of have to, a lot of the job is figuring out, okay, what are we going to focus on? It's like triage a lot of the time. But yeah, again, just seeking out a story that is compelling and then seeking out the hope. You know, you were talking about at the end of your screenings, giving people something they can do. It's so critical. And I think that's a really big part of the job. You know, some of it is storytelling, but we're not just stenographers, you know. We're here to share a little bit more and give a little bit of hope about what people can do with the information that they get.
Yeah, I would add to that. I think in the kind of mid-90s, there was kind of this glut of environmental documentaries, right? The cost of documentary filmmaking equipment came down. A lot more people were making films about environmental issues. And there were so many of these films that were just painting these dire pictures of the world that we live in. And then the film would end and you'd just be sitting there kind of like, oh, you know, and feeling powerless. And I experienced that so many times. And that was kind of right when I was learning about filmmaking and developing my voice. And I kind of made this commitment to myself that I wasn't going to make a film that would leave audiences feeling like that. Because I think when you learn something and you're angered by it or you feel disappointed, you need a next step. And I think part of our responsibility as filmmakers, even if we're telling very journalistic stories, is to, even if it means when the film is done and the reporting is done, providing some resources at least to learn more, really, if not to to do something. And I think a great thing that documentary filmmakers can do who aren't comfortable doing that research and telling people what those things are is partnering with organizations that are already doing that work and linking people with the work that's already happening so that they can support it if they choose, so that they can donate, volunteer, show up in a way that makes sense for them.
We see this at the festival as well with the films we show every year. We know that there's no such thing as just a film screening. The film is the first act, and then so much more comes after the filmmakers have a wealth of knowledge about the topic and the characters they've been invested in, and so many, as you said, organizations that are involved, ways to continue the story forward. So I have a question then. If you're working so closely on a topic, as you said, you're not just going in and observing, that you're becoming, dare I say, emotionally involved in the topic and with your characters. What happens then when you're moving on to your next project? How easy or hard is it to walk away? Or do you feel that connection is just going to continue? Misha, will you be going back and making Off the Sea Part 2?
sorry. Well, I'll answer that quickly. I mean, we actually are going to do a follow-up on one of our characters, okay. One of our subjects in the film, there's been kind of a complication to their story, and it actually takes place in Alaska. So we've been emailing about that. So much of filmmaking is about timing and just showing up at the right moment, and it's easy to want to just drop everything and go do that before you have money to do it. But what was the other part of your...
Well, it was just about how emotionally connected you get to the issues and to the characters. And
yeah, I mean, we're experiencing this with the film we're cutting right now. And a lot of times this happens in the editing process where you've spent this time with people, you know their stories, you know these people, and you want to paint a true picture of them. But a lot of times your emotional connection to a subject can kind of kill the momentum of your story if you focus too much on it, especially if you're focusing on multiple characters. And you really have to try to tease that apart and get fresh eyes on your film and have people watch the film who aren't connected with your characters because they're going to be able to provide that objectivity that you don't have having spent all that time with them. So that's something that we're struggling with right now with this film, is we don't want to lose any of these scenes with our characters because we know them, we care about them. But we also need to tell a story that's relevant to our audience and that tells a true story of the march and what took place.
Graylin and Jason, it seems that this story I imagine nearly completed the film that we are going to premiere next month. But that's not the end. In many ways, that story is just beginning. Will you be continuing to tell this story, or what do you think is going to happen in the months ahead in Alaska?
I can speak to that briefly. And any story that you get is going to live in your heart, not to be too cheesy about it, forever. And some of being a reporter is putting it aside and moving on to the next thing. But what's extraordinary about this story, I mentioned at the beginning that it started as one thing. It started actually as a print story for Bay Nature, a magazine in the Bay Area. And it was a story about the crab fishery in California and the science behind this algae bloom that had shut it down. And then months later, we were in Alaska filming this, and now we're here talking to you guys about it. And I spent the following summer after we filmed in South Central Alaska in Anchorage reporting on similar stories, including a whale die-off that is perhaps linked to the same problems with algae blooms. These things never really stop, and your information never ends with the end of a film. Your reporting process doesn't end there, too. So these things, you carry the emotional parts with you, and you keep working on sharing information.
I would just add that, I mean, it's a gift. Like, the emotional connection and the individuals that I've met, like, I'm going to carry them with me for the rest of my life, and that is one of the biggest gifts that I can be given. It's better than any type of remuneration or a grant that I may win, because at the end of the day, I got to, I mean, we left both of us were given salmon, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, people give you gifts in the last gifts of the day.
Yeah. salmon. No, actually, here's the better story. We're in with the gentleman that you see in the film, and he has a carving studio. And there is a child that's been running around the entire time that we've been with him, and he's not been identified to us as to who he is. And then it's explained the situation. It's not germane to the story, so we didn't include it. But he basically is a member of the family that, you know, someone had passed away, if I remember correctly, and he took on this child. And the child was sitting there listening to us and was wondering kind of why we were there. We ended up getting this question. And there was also a much older gentleman that was sitting in the back. And suddenly, at almost the end of our time, he walks up to us and gives us a paddle and says, "Please have a safe journey back where you're coming from." And that paddle now sits in my car as a just a reminder, and also a talisman, so to speak, of just, you know, the places that I go. So I don't look at this as a detriment. Of like the, you know, I have the pie will always be expanding, and there will be more than enough space to hold all of these stories and to hear and to continue this down the line. But I do want to return to one question that you had earlier, and that was about hope. Mm-hmm. Recently, Rebecca Solnit, who's a graduate of the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, came into a class that I was taking, and you know, she has a really interesting take on that word because it's a fraught word. Mm-hmm. In certain ways. And I've been thinking a lot about her book, A Paradise Built in Hell. And we make the choice as to how these situations are framed. You know, and that book really seeks to undo media narratives, if I may be so bold, about how certain situations where a catastrophe has happened, what actually occurs. And she shows through historical research that in the 1906 earthquake, people are not going at each other's throats. Class distinctions disappear, and suddenly everyone is taking care of their neighbor. You know, how do I want to say this? I really wish I wasn't having to live through this current situation, but I'm so emboldened by the way in which we are taking up questions of intersectionality in ways that I've never seen before, that I'm having conversations with women, what it means to be a gay man, and we're finding commonality and joining forces. And I actually think we're going to see a lot of change. And I see that in the green space. Mm-hmm. I see that in other civil rights spaces. And I think that, you know, it's a framing. And that's the choice that I make as a filmmaker is to how that's going to get framed in the myth that I'm creating for the audience. And I think that's something that we have to hold on to going forward. It's not just about the resources, but, you know, are we going to look at Katrina as a whole bunch of people looting, or are we going to look at Katrina as a whole bunch of people trying to survive a catastrophic event where they were forgotten?
And Misha, I mean, the Women's March came out of a particular moment, but there must. What are you finding, discovering about the motivation to march of the women that you've been interviewing?
Felt, you know, again as filmmakers, that it was our responsibility to really choose carefully which stories we were choosing to represent, because at the end of the day, filmmaking is not an objective art, and so much of the filmmaker's intentions are embedded in the story and what you end up watching, and so part of that was making a commitment to sharing stories about people of color, about people with different sexual orientations, people with different backgrounds, immigration status. I think the other challenge for us was also making sure that our filmmaking team was representing different voices. And that's something that we strive to do, but the reality is most of the people on our team are white and half of them are male, and we've received some negative feedback about that, and that's been a challenge for me, and because I know where our team is coming from, and everyone on our team is coming to this story because they want to amplify those voices, and I think that when we you know, in the times that, that we are living in, we need to really think about, as filmmakers and storytellers and journalists, what are the stories that we are, you know, driven to tell, and really examine why, and really examine where that's coming from, and recognize where we're uncomfortable and go there. Mm-hmm. And that has been a challenge. There have been many uncomfortable moments in making this film and talking about this film and talking about the filmmaking process of this film. And it's been a growing experience for me and the people on my team. So I think very much we need to be thinking about the stories we're telling and who we are giving a voice to. And making sure that it's not the same people who have always had voices.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is the San Francisco Green Film Festival, Film Stories from Your Dining Plate, with Rachel Kaplan, CEO, San Francisco Green Film Festival, Misha Hedges, Director of the Sea, Galen Brasher, co-director, Eyes on the Water, and Jason Hansik, co-director, Eyes on the Water. We've come to that point in our program where we have questions from the audience. And Rachel, I'll turn that over to you.
Thanks. I'm going to jump right into these questions here. There's a couple that relate directly to fishing and sustainability of seafood. I'm going to jump right into those. A question about do we know what's causing the algae blooms? What's contributing to them? Is there a man-made impact here?
Well, that is a really central question that we don't entirely know why we're getting increases in these blooms. Scientists who study these harmful algal blooms, the two top experts in the U.S. are here in Tiburon and then in Santa Cruz. They really don't have any doubt that a warming climate and warming oceans have something to do with it. A lot of these toxic species, they are happiest when the water is a little bit warmer than the natural climate in the northern Pacific. But there's so much that we don't know about them, and that's actually why the research is so critical. So our story is really primarily about the people in Southeast Alaska who are affected by this directly, these native tribes who decided, you know what, we're going to create a monitoring system to keep ourselves, our people safe. They're also gathering an enormous amount of data because they're taking water samples, they're taking shellfish samples, sending it back to a central lab in Sitka by seaplane because there's no other way to get it there. This is an expensive proposition. So with grants from NOAA, from a couple other organizations, they're basically creating an early warning system map. At the same time, they're gathering a lot of data that we don't have right now about where these blooms are occurring, how frequently, when they start in the early spring, when they end. And so it's helping to answer that question. That's part of why it's so critical. Definitely, warming oceans have something to do with it. Increasingly, acidic oceans perhaps play a role. But the real answer is we don't know.
And I would just add to that the adage up there is, you know, if it's the month of R, or if the month...
A month of an R. Similar to the oyster thing. Like, don't eat oysters in a month that doesn't have an R in it. So cold month's good.
And this has been these blooms have happened since time, you know, since anyone can remember. It's just that it's expanded is really what we're looking at. So, I mean, there's great stories in which they actually used these toxins as a defense mechanism from outsiders. They knew that the shellfish was poisonous and that they would feed the shellfish to them. I mean, very smart. I mean, if you're gonna have to defend, go with what's already in the natural system. But so this has been in place. But there's been a major shift because it's expanded exponentially outside of the normal season in which it would have occurred, and that's the concern.
A question from the audience for Misha, in regard to local fishermen, what's really impacting local fishermen here? Is it corporate fishing industry?
Not so much. The small boat fishermen in California, at least, they can find markets for their fish. Most of the barriers are economic. The cost of permits, the cost of slip fees where you keep your boat. On the coast of California, if anyone has been looking at coastal real estate, it's expensive and it's harder and harder to come by. And that's impacting fishing communities because as more people build mansions or there are more tourist industries sprouting up in coastal California towns. In Fisherman's Wharf right down here, one of the fishermen in our film, Sarah Bates, refers to it as a Disneyland. And this is and was a working fishing port, but it used to be much more so. And the kind of ironic thing is, if you go down to Fisherman's Wharf, most of the seafood that you're eating in those restaurants along the water are actually, it's imported fish, it's farmed fish from other countries. Salmon and crab are the exceptions. Most of that is going to be local or from the coast of Oregon or Washington. But yeah, it's mostly economic. It's also the regulations. That's more of a year-to-year thing. And there's relief sometimes when there isn't a season. There will be federal relief for fishermen. But it's definitely an economic challenge, mostly for them. Weather is also a huge factor. If it's a stormy year, it's just more dangerous, and they often don't get out as much.
Another question. What are the biggest challenges for you as a filmmaker in your career? Like, what are your hopes for the future? I think I know the answer to this. It probably comes down to the funding, I would imagine.
That's definitely part of it. Jason and I are very fortunate we had support from UC Berkeley to do this. I'm not a filmmaker. I guess I am now. But I came into this not having experience in this realm. It is really expensive. It is about the most expensive way to tell a story. If you're looking at, okay, you could write a print story about this for a magazine. You could do a story on public radio. Film is expensive. You know, you always have to have more than one person. It's hard to do it with just two, but it can be done. And it takes time, you know. You can't, especially with documentary, you can't set up a scene, you know. It's got to be right. You got to be there over and over again for the right moment. So time and money, like with everything, I think. And it also comes down to you all. You know, people have to be interested. You've got to find people to pick up the passion where you left off. So it's really remarkable to sit in a room like this and talk to people who you know care about these stories. But that's what you always hope for, that people are going to care.
And there are ways in which you can vote for this without having to spend money, like screening documentaries of this mm-hmm. nature on Netflix, which will change their algorithm, and then they will fund these types of things more and more. Or buy of the sea on Amazon, right, which will then show interest in this topic or come to the film festival.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Film festivals supporting independent film, choosing to watch content that is not a reality show, that is reporting that is a story that matters, really. And you know, I'm not always in a documentary mood when I sit down to watch Netflix. But I think really searching out those films that have a meaning in this world. And really the challenge is making a living and funding. I'm not a full-time documentary filmmaker because I can't afford it. We do client work. We work with great organizations and nonprofits, and filmmaking is something that we've been able to start self-funding out of that, but we always need outside sources. So it's a pretty competitive landscape in terms of documentary funding, grant funding. I know the festival is partially grant funded, and it's a pretty competitive landscape out there.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Unfortunately, we have reached that point in our program for our last questions. And since I'm chair of the environmental program, I get to ask the correct questions. So what I'm going to do is ask each of you these questions. And there are two questions. And we'll just start at when you're ready, Jason. We'll start and come on down the line. When you were growing up, did you think you would be a filmmaker and make films about people and the environment? That's question one. And then I'm going to ask you another question after that.
No. I started in the visual art world, and I made it to my dream, one of my dream venues, the Smithsonian's National Portrait Gallery, and I realized I wanted to have a larger conversation with a broader public and not just the art public, and so I made an about face and went back to get another master's degree, and now I do that, but not in my childhood.
When you were a child, did you have a favorite film that you remember today? Or one that stands out for you that maybe was scary?
Oh, I mean, for sure, The Wicked Witch and The Wizard of Oz.
I think a lot of people were scared by that Wicked Witch. Galen, you're our next person, and same question.
Okay.
When you were growing up, did you think you would be a filmmaker about being making films about people and the environment?
Not making films, for sure. I think I probably always knew that I wanted to tell stories. I actually wanted to be a scientist for a really long time, and failed chemistry when I got to college and realized that maybe I shouldn't do that. Wasn't actually that good at it. But taking in knowledge, especially about the natural world, and processing it and then telling stories with that information has always appealed to me and been great, just an amazing way to move through the world. And being a reporter is a fantastic way to do that. I think it probably is pretty telling that my favorite movie when I was a kid was Bambi. I'm pretty sure I broke the VHS tape because I watched it so many times, so there we go.
That's amazing. Misha, same question. When you were growing up, did you think you would be a filmmaker and make films about people and the environment?
Not as a preteen, but certainly when I was in high school, about midway through, I was in an environmental science course, and it involved a lot of hands-on field work. And I was also a video geek at that moment, and you know, making all kinds of fun little music videos. And I didn't really connect those two before that, but there was an opportunity to make a film about a local forest that was going to be logged right outside of where I grew up in Mendocino. And I made a short film that was used in the fundraising efforts to purchase about 3,000 acres and turn it into a state park. And it was by no means my film alone that did that. Many people worked on it, but it showed me, you know, at the age of 15 or 16, that media and stories can make a difference and can move hearts and minds and encourage people to take action. And so that was impactful for me. And from that moment, I definitely knew that I wanted to do this.
Okay, when you were a child, did you have a favorite film or movie?
I love the film Traffic by Steven Soderbergh. It's several parallel stories about how drugs affect people at the family level, at the individual level, at the political level, at the policing level. And it's just a fascinating film to me that really shaped my appreciation for film.
So, Rachel, we're going to ask you the same question. When you were growing up, did you think you would be in the film business and the environment?
Film, yes. And I've been working in film for a long time, film festivals in Europe and here in the U.S. The environmental calling came later. And certainly if I'd known what was involved in founding and launching a film festival, I probably would never have done it. But here we are, and it's been just wonderful because the difference I see it makes when we have a full house of people and the curtain opens and the lights go down and the film starts, and everyone in that room is completely connected to what's unfolding on the screen, and we see this day after day after day and the impact that this makes. So I, you know, hats off to the filmmakers who are working so hard to bring us these stories.
And to you for creating a place to show it.
Oh, yes.
So Rachel, did you have a favorite film when you were younger?
Many. I might just, now you said Bambi, I'm going to say Watership Down.
Oh,
because
yeah.
The writer died quite recently and I had a moment.
So now I'm going to ask the audience, just raise your hand. Are there more than the two of us, Jason, you and me, who were scared of that wicked witch? It's interesting that we have about 6 or 7 people. So that's amazing that we still remember that film, right?
We'll start a support group.
We better start a support group. And Rachel, you wanted to make some comments.
Just to wrap up, if you want to continue this conversation with us, I invite you to join us at the Green Film Fest on April 23rd for the world premiere of Graylin Brashear and Jason Hanasek's film, Eyes on the Water, as part of a Food for Thought program of films. Also the same day, April 23rd, Misha Hedges will show the world premiere of his new film, Women's March. Both those events are at the Roxy Theatre. Also, check out greenfilmfest.org for the full lineup of 70 films and 90 guest speakers coming April 20th to 26th in San Francisco and Berkeley. So join us and find out more about what's on your plate. Thank you very much. Thank you to the guests.
Thank you.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is the San Francisco Green Film Festival, Film Stories from Your Dining Plate. And we were lucky to have tonight Rachel Kaplan, who's the CEO of the San Francisco Green Film Festival, Misha Hedges, who is the director of The Sea, and he was very much welcome to us, as each of you are. Graylin Brashear, co-director, Eyes on the Water, and Jason Hanasek, who's also a co-director of Eyes on the Water. So let's give them a big hand for being here with us tonight. Many, many thanks to our speakers, and many, many thanks to our wonderful audience here. Let's give ourselves a big hand. On the radio, on podcasts, and the internet with the Commonwealth Club. Find our programs on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Click on our website, watch and listen for Commonwealth Club videos, radio schedules, and subscribe to our weekly free podcasts and program archives. We also want to invite you to come for our upcoming environmental programs, Monday, March 27th, the Spring 2017 report on the Sierra Nevada's rain, snowpack, trees, water, ecosystems, and climate change. On Thursday, May 25th, the SF Recology, the San Francisco Recology, will have a program about plastic waste, from plastic waste, landfills, and garbage to healthy resources and reuse. The planet is slowly becoming a plastic planet, and San Francisco Recology is making every effort to make sure that we do not become a plastic planet. Thursday on June 8th, we'll have the Presidio Golf Course, who will talk about the modeling that they have done for a sustainable and environmental design for golf courses that includes the environment and water resources. Be a wonderful program, and you, if you want, go look up all your favorite golf places and think about them and let them know about the Presidio Golf Course and what they've been able to do in terms of the environment, which has really been very, very good and spectacular. And finally, we want to thank you, as I mentioned, for our audience here tonight and on our podcasts and on our radios. And this is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. I want to thank once again Rachel Kaplan, who's CEO of the San Francisco Green Film Festival, Misha Hedges, Director of The Sea, Graylin Brashear, Co-Director of Eyes on the Water, and Jason Hanasek, who's Co-Director, Eyes on the Water. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure to meet you.
Nice to meet you.